This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The feds do have a track record here. They do have evidence that, you know, they've accumulated over the course of the last 5 years. So I wouldn't be surprised if he goes down. But it would also, you know, by the same token, be unprecedented. No one's ever convicted a coal company CEO of this kind of thing before.
In corporate crime, individual accountability is notoriously elusive. Even when egregious crimes take place, wherein hundreds of people are robbed of their savings, or tens of people die because of profit-motivated negligence, we rarely see any individuals held accountable. Today on Sea Change Radio, we discuss an exception to that rule. Former CEO of Massey Energy, Don Blankenship, is currently on trial for conspiracy to violate mandatory mine safety and health standards, making false statements to the SEC, and securities fraud. Blankenship is being held personally responsible for aspects of the Upper Big Branch disaster of 2010 and the ensuing cover-up. Here to discuss the trial is Mother Jones reporter Tim Murphy. We talk about Blankenship's history with Massey, the current legal proceedings, and whether this prosecution is a harbinger for the demise of the coal industry in general. Would the case have unfolded this way 15 years ago when coal was still king? Or is Blankenship basically a canary in the coal mine, signaling to the industry that the fumes are getting toxic? I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by senior reporter from Mother Jones, Tim Murphy. Tim, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a recent piece in Mother Jones entitled The Fall of King Coal about the hot water that Don Blankenship is in. He's the former CEO or chairman of Massey Energy, a big West Virginia-based coal company that sold to Alpha Natural Resources a few years ago. Why don't you first tell us who Don Blankenship is and why he's in trouble, and then we'll dig into a little bit more of his past.
Sure. Well, you know, Don Blankenship was, he started off with very humble beginnings in one of the poorest counties in the United States, Mingo County, West Virginia, and rose to become the CEO of Massey, which at the time that he left was the fourth largest coal producer in the United States. It was the largest in Central Appalachia. So he was really a giant of the industry, and it was a publicly traded company. It was a Fortune 1000 company. And Blankenship did all of this by investing heavily in coal reserves, even if the market was going south, by building up a lot of mountaintop removal sites to get at the coal under the mountains, by busting the unions that had kind of been born in his backyard in southern West Virginia, and by, you know, at times sort of making a mockery of federal mine safety violations. You know, the Massey owned some of the most dangerous mines in Appalachia. You know, they racked up safety violations. They had more fatalities than their competitors. And this culminated in 2010 when 29 miners died at the Upper Big Branch site at a Massey-owned property in southern West Virginia. Blankenship is currently in federal court. He's not facing charges related to that disaster, which was the worst at a U.S. mine in 40 years. But the indictment period does sort of center around that incident. He's being charged with conspiracy to commit mine safety violations at his properties, and with lying to federal investigators and regulators about his company's safety records on his annual reports by suggesting that safety was the company's number one priority and that it was doing everything necessary to protect its miners while allegedly taking pretty serious steps to do the opposite.
What is he facing right now, and what are legal analysts telling reporters like yourself that of his likelihood of going to prison for a lengthy period of time?
So he faces a maximum of 30 years if he's convicted on every count. I think, you know, the biggest count is about 26 years for lying to the SEC. And again, that's a maximum sentence, so it's not a guarantee that he would get any of that if convicted. The fact that he's in federal court is generally means that, you know, the deck is stacked against him. So it's going to be an uphill struggle. But he left the company, Massey Energy, shortly before it was acquired by Alpha Natural Resources for about $7 billion. And he got an $82 million severance package out of that. So he had, and Alpha lost the lawsuit so that it is actually paying his legal bills for this.
Really?
Yeah. And so, you know, he's got access to some pretty good lawyers, as you would expect. And they are, you know, they're putting up a pretty good fight right now in court, making essentially the argument that he wasn't fully responsible for everything that was going on in his mine, you know, and that MSHA, the federal mine regulators, were actually preventing him in some cases from making the fixes that he needed to make to keep the mine safe. So that's their argument anyway. And we'll probably know in about a week or two whether that holds up.
So I want to read this quote that you use in the piece. You also have a video of this, but Blankenship, this is from years ago. Was this in the 80s, where he says, "What you have to accept in a capitalist society generally is that it's like a jungle, where a jungle is survival of the fittest. Unions, communities, people, everybody's going to have to learn to accept that in the United States you have a capitalist society and that capitalism from a business viewpoint is survival of the most productive." I couldn't help but think that that same credo has kind of turned in on coal barons like Blankenship, as coal is kind of a dying breed.
Yeah, and that quote comes from, I believe, 1984 and 1985, which is really the moment when he emerged on the scene and solidified his reputation within the industry. He was, you know, he was hired as an accountant at a mine company just down the street from where he grew up in Mingo County, West Virginia, and he was very quickly promoted to president of this Massey-owned subsidiary around the time when United Mine Workers of America decided, you know, to sort of make a message out of Massey and to organize a really coordinated strike against Massey in order to force them, you know, to bring, you know, bring wages up and really treat the mine workers with the respect they felt they earned. Blankenship, in charge of this company at the time, decided that he would, you know, he would make a statement out of this, and he kind of held strong against the workers and ended up devolving into violence. I think one scab truck driver was killed. Blankenship has a TV in his office that he says, you know, was shot up by the mine workers. Mine workers, you know, bosses had their homes shot up. You know, they had sandbags around their headquarters. But at the end of this, Blankenship had kind of broken the union in Mingo County and at Massey, Massey-owned companies, and was very shortly thereafter promoted within the company, eventually to president and CEO. So that's kind of the backstory of him offering that quote. And I think it's interesting what you said in terms of capitalism rearing its head, because, you know, for all of the talk about the Obama administration's environmental regulations, which of course, you know, don't help the industry, it's really fallen victim to natural gas in the last decade or so. And that's what people are choosing for their coal, you know, for their energy instead of coal, because it's just enormously cheaper. So that is sort of the death knell for the industry in Appalachia at the moment.
At least in terms of 10 years ago, when there were still coal analysts who were saying we got 100 years of coal in the ground, it's still the future, like it or not.
Yeah, and what Blankenship, the pressures that he was facing when he was rising within the company was Wyoming. So, you know, Nixon era regulations had really clamped down on West Virginia, and in order to drive profits out of that, you had to really crack the whip. And Blankenship's strength was that he ran the company with an iron fist, that he, you know, kept he kept his subordinates on the phone. There was literally a red phone at the Upper Big Branch mine, and when that phone rang, it meant that Don Blankenship was on the line. So he was able to, in a crumbling industry, squeeze profits out of it longer than other companies were. But Alpha Natural Resources, the company that bought Massey, filed for bankruptcy 2 months ago.
Really?
Yeah. So and some other companies have followed suit. So it's a pretty rough climate out there, so to speak.
Can you trace some kind of a transformative era or moment in Mr. Blankenship's tenure as a coal executive where he broke from the unions. He was a United mine worker at some point, correct?
He was, actually. That, you know, that's one of the interesting things about Blankenship. So he grows up in a really hard scrabble part of the country. You know, he lived in a trailer across from a gas station that his mother owned in a little town called DeLorme, West Virginia, right across the Tug Fork River from Kentucky, where he was actually born, in a little place called Stopover. And he pulled his way up and ended up going to Marshall University to study accounting and to pay his way through college, and he graduated in 3 years. He worked summers at a United Mine Workers mine run by the Pittston Coal Company. You know, and he did that for a few years, and so he was a member of the union. I don't think he ever really had a true allegiance to the union. And I think from the start, I think maybe, you know, from the example that he had growing up, or growing up in a place where you couldn't really count on the government, even as, you know, folks probably needed a lot of assistance. So, for example, the town down the stream, down the river from where he grew up, the bridge collapsed, and there was no state funding to rebuild it, and so the city ended up appealing to the Soviet Union to provide funding. I mean, it was kind of a bleak economic and political situation, and so I think that hardened him, it toughened him, and it made him pretty cynical about government and about unions and that kind of thing. And so by the time he joined Massey, you know, he got to the company at a time, due to these dropping, you know, revenues and tougher to access coal seams, that it was looking for a way to distinguish itself from its competitors, and it was looking for a way to cut costs. And what E. Morgan Massey, the president of the company, clued in on was unions. And, you know, if you made yourself a non-union workplace, you know, you would gain not just by lower salaries, but you would gain by significantly lower benefits down the road. They had a thing called the Massey Doctrine that was written in 1982, around the time that Blankenship joined the company. And it zeroed in right on that, you know, kind of relying less on unions and relying more on outside contractors to run your workplace, which would enable you to defer these kinds of costs to contractors. And, you know, of course, if a contractor can't pay it, that's not your fault. So he joined the company at a time when it was distinguishing itself, even amidst, you know, a pretty rough industry in terms of Appalachian coal. And he made his way up the company by excelling at this kind of cost cutting and you know, and union busting and that kind of thing.
All you coal miners, wherever you may be, listen to the story that I relate to thee. My name is nothing extra, but the truth to you I tell. I am a coal miner, and I'm sure I wish you well. I was born in old Kentucky.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mother Jones reporter Tim Murphy. We're discussing his recent piece in Mother Jones, The Fall of King Coal, talking about Don Blankenship, the former chairman of Massey Energy in West Virginia. Take us to the mining accident that occurred a few years before Blankenship left the company.
Yeah, so this was the Upper Big Branch mine disaster in 2010, and it left 29 miners died, which at the time made it the worst mining disaster in 40 years. And it wasn't, you know, of course, the first fatality at a Massey-owned mining site. And you know, almost all coal companies, you know, have fatalities from time to time. Even before Upper Big Branch, Massey, I think, was notorious in the industry. And if you crunch the numbers, as some folks have done, it was still, it still had the deadliest mines in Central Appalachia. But this was kind of a historic event. And, you know, if you look at the investigative reports that were churned out both by the state and by the federal government, you know, it makes clear that this was essentially a powder keg waiting to explode, almost literally. To be, you know, mines aren't spotless, but you're, you know, there's a reason that, you know, the Federal Mine, you know, Safety and Health Administration exists and conducts regular, you know, inspections and docks you.
It's historically a very dangerous job.
Yeah, and coal dust is one of those things that you know that you're supposed to clean up and shouldn't be coating the inside of a mine. You know, gases can collect inside of a mine, and traditionally, you know, one of the biggest causes of death inside of a mine is from explosions, whether that's from gases exploding or coal dust or some combination of all of this. And so mine safety law essentially exists to prevent these kinds of explosions from happening and you know, in the long term, reducing the risk of black lung. All of these conditions existed at the Upper Big Branch mine. It was just kind of every single bad thing from a safety standpoint compiled into one site. And so ultimately it was a spark set off by a shearing machine on the longwall section of the mine that just precipitated this blast that went on for, I think, 3 miles underground. You know, and the gas had accumulated over the weekend after, you know, there was one day off in the mine, which is pretty rare, especially in a Massey site. But they got a day off for Easter, and they came back, and there was just this tremendous blast, and 29 people died. But, you know, it was one of those things where you could look back and you could see the writing on the wall in a way at some of the previous incidents. So, for instance, you know, in 2006, there was a blast at a Massey-owned site called the Aracoma, you know, run by the Aracoma Coal Company, in which there were 2 fatalities. And the state report in that case identifies this kind of pattern at the mine and really keys in on pressure coming down from the company as part of its ethos of production at all costs, and really kind of pointed the finger at the company and suggested that, you know, Blankenship's leadership was in some way having an effect on the safety of the mines. It was 2006. It was the Bush administration. You know, it was a Bush-appointed U.S. attorney, so there wasn't any subsequent investigation into Blankenship, just some kind of low-level mine officials, you know, took the fall for that. But, you know, 4 years later, when this happened at Upper Big Branch, I don't think industry experts and safety folks were too surprised that it was Massey.
And let's get back to his court case. So he's being confined right now to his section of the state. Is he going to be tried in a federal court, or is there a chance that he's going to get some home cooking when it comes to the trial?
No, he's currently being tried in a federal court in Charleston, West Virginia. So the closest court to the Upper Big Branch site was in a town called Beckley.
Will this be a jury trial?
Yep, they've finished the jury selection, and right now they're in the middle of the trial, and they've been listening for the past few days to audio that was secretly recorded by Don Blankenship of his own conversation. So it's sort of a Nixonian twist. And in these conversations, you know, he's discussing everything from, you know, spreadsheets and the bottom line to his frustrations with mine safety and mine safety regulators and his own fears at some point about the really rough conditions of the mines.
These are tapes that the prosecutors are playing for the jury.
Yeah, yeah.
Has there been anything revelatory from it?
You know, I think it, you know, it's a conspiracy case. It's a conspiracy to commit mine safety violations. So they're really working hard to just kind of establish him in the eyes of the jury as somebody who worshipped the almighty dollar and somebody who was very intensively involved in everything that was going on at the company. And you know, to put those two things together, to say that if Massey was deliberately getting in the way of investigators and deliberately breaking the law, it was because Blankenship was telling him, the company, to do that. So the you know, these tapes, you know, they don't have any, like, you know, they don't have Don Blankenship saying, like, you know, we need to make this, you know, the least safe mine we possibly can. They don't have any kind of moment like that. But, you know, as the prosecutors are just hoping to kind of, you know, the accumulation of them, you know, will combine to form this portrait in the eyes of the jury. And to your point about, you know, home cooking, I think that's the opposite of what Blankenship is expecting. His lawyers have been fighting, or were fighting up until the day of the trial, to get this case moved out of the state entirely. They wanted it moved to Baltimore, actually. They wanted it absolutely out of coal country. They didn't want anyone involved with the coal industry anywhere near this case sitting on the jury, because I think they recognized that although Blankenship has presented himself as kind of a savior the coal company who's fighting to keep jobs in the state against, you know, the tyrannical Obama regime, he's actually pretty well hated in the state and among people who have ties to the industry. And they did polling on that in southern West Virginia, which is part of the reason they were able to get the case moved a little bit further away from the Upper Big Branch site in the first case.
So despite his political weight, he is universally reviled by the working class of West Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, and that was at least as presented by Blankenship's attorneys, and I think if they're making that case, I don't know if the prosecution would even really dispute it. I think there maybe before Upper Big Branch or something like that, his reputation, you know, that kind of negative reputation would have been more confined to members of unions or environmentalists or that kind of thing. But I think to give you an example, in the 2014 election, there was a congressional election in which both the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate were sort of going out of their way to bash Blankenship, and each candidate was accusing the other of being too close to him. So there's kind of a race, you know, among politicians, even as he's helped get a number of these folks elected and given to their campaigns to kind of distance themselves from him.
Stood in line for the union, fought against the company, stood for the UN. Who's gonna stand by me? Got no job and I got no pay. I just got a weary soul and this blue tattoo on the side of my face, left by the number 9 code, left by the number 9 code.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mother Jones reporter Tim Murphy. You sum up Don Blankenship's complexity at the end of the piece when you quote one of his former high school classmates, Wilma Steele. Why don't you explain that discussion you had with Ms. Steele?
Yeah, and you know, Matewan is an incredibly historic town for a bit of American history that a lot of people don't know, and it's not really taught in schools except in West Virginia. And it actually happens to involve the namesake of my magazine, Mary Harris Jones, Mother Jones. I mean, this is really where the United Mine Workers were baptized in the 1920s and the 1910s. There would just be open, you know, gunfights in the city of Matewan between, you know, union organizers and by, you know, private detectives owned by the mining companies. And, you know, there was an open air battle, the Battle of Blair Mountain, in which, you know, 10,000 mine workers faced off against 3,000 guards. It's the largest fight on American soil, you know, between Americans since the Civil War, and it still is. So this is an incredibly rich history. And so there's a Mine Wars Museum in Matewan. It's new. It's great. If you're in the area, you should check it out. Just, you know, really fascinating stuff. But it's also funded in part by the United Mine Workers of America. And when Don Blankenship, you know, who still lives just outside the town of Matewan, decided to stop by and check it out, you know, I think he felt like maybe it was an affront to what he was all about or something like that. And, you know, he had a chat with this woman, Wilma Steele, who works there. And he told her, well, you know, this looks okay, but what it really needs is mummies. And she kind of gave him a look and he said, union mummies.
What is a union mummy?
Exactly. I don't know if that was like a thinly veiled reference to the fact that the United Mine Workers is kind of in a slow decline in the state and in central Appalachia.
I see. So he was not saying that coal is dead, but he killed the unions. So they're ancient history.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he didn't return my question on that. But it was kind of a weird cryptic thing to say it. At least that was Wilma's impression of that. But I do think it's worth emphasizing, you know, for all the kind of villainous reputation that he has in southern West Virginia and you know, potentially facing 3 decades in federal prison, he still lives outside Matewan. He still lives 15 minutes from the gas station and trailer that he grew up in. You know, he was the only Fortune 1000 company CEO who lived in West Virginia, and he lived in his hometown in one of the poorest counties in the state, poorest counties in the country. He has a strong attachment to the area, and you know, he has deep family roots in the area. And you know, people don't just turn their back on people like that. You know, Wilma Steele, the woman who worked at the Mine Workers Museum, you know, who comes from a mine working family, you know, I think she put it to me in a really interesting way, which is that, you know, when this is all over, she hopes that Blankenship comes back. And that Blankenship comes back to Matewan and spends some of his money and does something good for the community after he goes to prison.
Yeah, after he goes to prison, I guess. So that's going to be interesting. Now that you've seen this trial unfold in its early stages, do you think that Don Blankenship will be doing hard time?
My great lesson in life is to never try and read the mind of a jury. But I will say, you know, to the government's case is that this is not the first case to come out of the Upper Big Branch disaster. You know, the U.S. attorney in southern West Virginia has prosecuted a number of cases in the aftermath of that, you know, including some Massey subordinates, including Don Blankenship's director of security at that mine, you know, who pled guilty to destruction of evidence. And so they've established already in federal court, you know, that there was a system at Upper Big Branch to evade federal inspectors. And there was like an intercom that whoever was at the front gate would get on and alert the people down in the mine, you know, when an inspector was coming so that they could do these very modest, you know, safety improvements in that 5, 10, 15 minutes that they had before the inspectors got down to the lower levels. They've convicted some foremen already. So this is the culmination of a series of federal investigations. It's not the beginning by any stretch. So, you know, the feds do have a track record here. They do have evidence that, you know, they've accumulated over the course of, you know, the last 5 years. So I wouldn't be surprised if he goes down, but it would also, you know, by the same token, be unprecedented. No one's ever convicted a coal company CEO of this kind of thing before.
So if people want to follow this case, you're not going to be the beat reporter on it, but where do you recommend interested listeners go?
I'd recommend they go to the Charleston Gazette and Mail and read everything Ken Ward Jr. writes. He's been their reporter in the courtroom following the trial. He's watched Don Blankenship for a decade or two, and that'll really give you a sense of how things are going in the courtroom.
Tim Murphy, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Afrocubism, Uncle Tupelo, and Warren Haynes.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.